the My Michelle Live podcast.
Looking for the God story and news of the day. My Michelle Live, news and views. Here's Michelle.
Hey! I am Michelle Mendoza. Thanks for joining with us today. This is what we call News and Views Thursday. On News and Views Thursday, we take on some of the big news stories, some that you've heard, some you may not, and you really should. It is a very weird world that we live in today. It's a world where you're not always hearing everything. You're certainly not hearing both sides reported. You are certainly not hearing all of the news stories that really have a relevance to you and I and our way of life. So we tried to take that on News and Views Thursday. And today on News and Views Thursday, ladies and gentlemen, it is all about the ice cream
truck. How about you and ice cream? I can test of my luck.
All right, that's enough of that. We're reporting a news story that comes out of Israel and comes out of the ice cream aisle. We're going to be doing it as we take a look, a view from Jerusalem with Rabbi Yitzhak Adlerstein of the Simon Wiesenthal Center.
And now a view from Jerusalem with Rabbi Adlerstein.
Rabbi, thanks for joining us today. I'm going to play a news story. You will not be able to see it. I'm sorry, but our viewers will be able to view it. This is coming from Ben and Jerry's, and it's coming at Israel.
Believe it or not, ice cream is top of the news agenda here in Israel, because on Monday, Ben & Jerry's announced that from the end of next year, it will no longer sell its product in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Vermont-based company behind products like Chunky Monkey and Fish Food said that the continued sale of its product in these areas was inconsistent with its values, and announced that from the end of next year, it will terminate an agreement it has with an Israeli manufacturer and distributor to produce its product here in Israel. And financially, it's not a big deal, but politically, it's been pretty explosive. The Prime Minister called the senior CEO of Unilever to complain. Unilever, of course, owns Ben & Jerry's. Now, this isn't Ben & Jerry's first foray into politics. The company has been very vocal on political issues, on everything from the issue of climate change to same-sex marriage.
And now they are getting out of the West Bank altogether. They say there is a reason. Apparently, human rights groups have been putting pressure on Ben & Jerry's for some time. The UN Security Council says that Israel is violating human rights and the rights of Palestinians. And so Ben & Jerry's says this is not consistent with our brand and who we are. This interesting little bout in your ice cream aisle is having huge implications. Rabbi, you were recently on the 700 Club talking about this very issue. I'll play just a moment of that. Here we go.
Rabbi Yitzhak Adlerstein of the Simon Wiesenthal Center told CBN News that many are underestimating the impact of the boycott.
To link Ben and Jerry's, to link that corporate image with the idea that Israel is a colonialist, brutal oppressor of a country that was stillborn and shouldn't be here, that's the real problem.
Rabbi, interesting, because Ben and Jerry's is suffering to a degree. You know, they have every right to believe as they believe, but they're suffering to a degree of what I call selective outrage. Would you agree?
What you call selective outrage, we call anti-Semitism. And when Jews are consistently treated to a different standard than other people, they're not always, but there is room for suspicion that things haven't changed much in 2,000 years. There's so much virtue signaling around us, which I really want to get your opinion on, Michelle. for people who pick a target and then show how virtuous they are by announcing their ire and not in our name, and they're totally inconsistent with not applying the same standard elsewhere. People are worried, and they should, about a group of people who have not been given a fair shrift in decades. I believe the critics are pointing a finger in the wrong place, but the fact is that the Palestinians deserve the sympathy and they deserve a better deal. But so do the hundreds of thousands of Syrians just a few miles away, where people are not speaking up for a regime that's using barrel bombs against their own citizens. We're watching a real genocide, not the phony one that some of the BDS people are talking about, a real genocide in China. And unlike some people in World War II who genuinely did not know the extent of Nazi atrocities, we've known about this now for close to 2 years. We know about concentration camps. We know about the conditions that people are being held under. We've watched massive installations for holding a million people. And nobody is saying, you know what? We should really prevail against Walmart or against Amazon and put some pressure. But people are not willing to do that. What they are willing to do is say, well, consciously, we really don't like Jews. So let's pick on them without regard for their security, without regard for the reality of how you could actually bring about some positive change for Palestinians. How many people who support BDS know that the Palestinian Authority itself is against boycotts because they hurt Palestinian workers? So yes, there's some selective stuff going on, and it makes people feel good, but that's not the full extent of it, Michelle. As I said on the 700 Club, that there's a combination of things that are like a double whammy for Jews and for non-Jews. Part of it is that the virtue signalers are trying to do is, as I heard this guy Adlerstein say a few minutes ago, to create an impression with the public. Most people don't think too deeply into things. That's why MSM, mainstream media, has such a profound effect upon people, even though in a recent poll of 46 countries, Americans were at the bottom of the list in confidence in media. They don't believe it, but by watching it often enough, you get the same impression. The impression here is Ben and Jerry's is good. Look at the beautiful cartoons on their package and the delicious flavors. I like Ben and Jerry's. Ben and Jerry's good. Israel bad. And that's all you have to do. And you promote that figure in a time that global anti-Semitism is just skyrocketing.
Yes.
The streets on the street for being Jewish. That's another factor, and certainly not the only one. But what BDS is trying to do here is to create the impression that Israel is a pariah state, and it doesn't take that much. You take a Ben and Jerry's all full of light and sweetness, and create, well, these guys are boycotting Israel. It means Israel's bad, and that's a huge gain.
If they're going to all of that trouble, then surely there is something to their concerns. That's what goes through the minds of a lot of Americans. And you've talked about BDS, which is the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement. They are trying to end international support for Israel's, what they call, oppression of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian state. it is very easy for us to be presented with a picture. Imagine someone going out with their camera. They take lots of photographs. They go through the photographs and they pick the picture that tells the story they want told. They give that, they put that picture up on billboards. They put that picture up on television and it tells a story. Now, there may be some truth to that story, but it's not the entire story. It's merely a snapshot. One of the reasons I was so excited to take this on today, Ben and Jerry's is a household name. I could walk right now, Rabbi, within a mile to a Ben and Jerry's store and pick up my favorite flavor, Chunky Monkey. But today, I'm a little reticent, and here's why. We have this big story that is but a snapshot of what is happening in that region. It does not tell the whole story. Now, you are sitting in a place with a view from Jerusalem. You are centralized there. You can see more of that story than the snapshot that we've been given. Can you tell us a bit more of what's really going on and why this Ben and Jerry's story, this snapshot, doesn't give the entire picture?
Sure. You're giving me far more of a platform than I had hoped for, because I didn't even think that that your generosity would be necessary to advance the argument about why this is so terrible. But as long as you're allowing me the opportunity, look, the BDS story completely is one-sided. Israel is the oppressor. Oppressor for what exactly? Palestinians do not have a good life. They have been behind the eight ball. They don't have the quality of life that they should, although they have been thriving mostly, at least according to the statistics. Birth rate is stable. That's a crazy way to do a genocide. Education is better than most parts of the Arab world. Nonetheless, people like freedom. They want autonomy. We can argue about whether there was a Palestinian identity. I don't think you can find any evidence of it before 1967, but that's all irrelevant. They deserve better. Who is the one who's been oppressing them? It's their own leadership, their corruption of the kleptocracy of the PA and the terrorists in Hamas and their inability to govern because they've taken all the money, either keeping it for themselves, which is what the PA has done, or building terror tunnels, which is what Hamas has done in Gaza. Everything that Israel does, look at all the civilians who were killed, but look at all the measures that Israel took not to kill civilians while they lobbed 4,400 rockets into Israel. That doesn't get mentioned.
Very conveniently, I would add.
Able to negotiate, only to find that there was no one to negotiate. Bill Clinton, going back way to prehistory, thought he had made real progress, and he had. And they had an agreement which had worked out 99% of what would be necessary for the creation of a Palestinian state. And Arafat walked away from it. He just couldn't bring himself to do it. I'm not going to make peace with the Jews. So, you know, those are some of the things that are missing. What will a boycott accomplish? That it's not going to bring people closer to the negotiating table. Does anybody believe that you can have peace in that region by imposing it on one side? Neither the Israeli side nor the Palestinian side. Meanwhile, you live here. One of the pleasant surprises I've had, and I hope I'm not being too naive, is that it was a terrible blow to us here in Israel that during the recent engagement with Hamas in Gaza, there was parts of the country, that we thought people actually thought themselves as loyal Israeli citizens with a gripe. They're part of the opposition, or they wanted a better life. And they've also been underappreciated. But it was a real blow, and we wondered whether we could ever recover from it. All I can tell you is that living here in Jerusalem, where we have daily interaction with Palestinians, with Israeli Arabs and Palestinian workers who are allowed in, it seems to me like it's back to normal. People greet each other civilly. They care for each other. They'll do favors for each other. They'll stop to help somebody. And that's what people don't live. They think we're in the middle of a war zone and this impossible hatred between Jews and Arabs. Yeah, the PA does a lot of it. The imams in their mosques do a lot of it. A lot of people out there who really don't want it. When you have this impression as Americans that Israeli settlers are breaking up the possibility of a contiguous Palestinian state, come here, stand on a hilltop and see how much room there is out there and how just by looking at the size of Palestinian villages and Jewish villages for that matter, the country could take 10 times the number of people that are currently here without batting an eyelash. And but people say, no, it's those settlements that are getting in the way. The settlements are not getting in the way. And you're calling them the barriers to peace are not bringing Israelis and Palestinians any closer to the negotiating table. What's needed is for a younger generation of Palestinians to say, we've had enough of this. We don't believe the imams. We certainly are fed up with people who are stealing the billions of dollars that Europe and the United States committed to us. And we want something better. We just want to live our lives in self-government. They have it.
Now, interestingly enough, the money issue is a big issue. Ben and Jerry's is not the first to go down this road. Airbnb had made a similar statement. We don't want to do business there. Well, what did that do? That hurt many individual people. It hurt many individuals who owned homes, who listed them and had contracts with Airbnb. They were Palestinian owners. There were Israeli owners. And they're saying, well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. So there was a lawsuit. Well, Airbnb was going to have to pay reparations to a degree. And they said, oh, well, I think we're going to change our stance on this. What they did do was decide that all of their proceeds, they would donate to the cause that they do believe in, which I think is likely a more logical way to go about this. So you hurt less people. Ben and Jerry's pulling out, Rabbi. They're hurting a lot of the Palestinian workers that are there at those ice cream shops. But interestingly enough, that money that gets donated oftentimes never reaches the intended target.
Right. And I'm so glad that you brought this up, because then maybe I can steer part of this conversation in another direction that I had in mind. And that is, I'm going to pose the question to you. How would you define the difference between genuinely making a contribution and virtue signaling? There's a lot of virtue signaling around, and a lot of this BDS stuff is from people who don't know the first thing about the Middle East, couldn't find Israel on a map if they tried, but they know it was a colonialist oppressor. Why are they there? How many Arab states are there? I don't know. It's 22. How many Jewish states are there in the world? 36? 27? No, one.
One.
But you know, it's a theocracy. Yeah, some theocracy. But you know, they call it a Jewish state surrounded by 22 countries, all of whom call themselves the Islamic State of. But that's not a problem. So how do you, but people get this genuine joy of saying, I'm from the ones who are pure and I'm against oppression. And it takes over their lives. And I'm sure they're sincere about it to an extent, but somehow as a religious person, I don't think you could be completely at home with that. I'm not, but I want to hear from you first.
Yeah, I find it in line with demonization. It feels good to make someone into the enemy. That makes me the hero. I am the savior. I am the good. You are the bad. We have a problem in our society of demonization, and here in the United States, critical race theory, for example, is being propagated in our schools. It's a theory that says that if you are white, you are inherently bad. Children are inherently bad, and they hate each other, and they come with privilege. Tell that to the poor kids who have never seen a family member in college and never owned a pair of shoes in the foothills there in Tennessee. There is an idea of demonization, and the demonization dehumanizes people. It dehumanizes, it criticizes, it makes you less than human. And if you are less than human and you are pure evil, then there really is no working with you. There is only an idea of destroying you. In that, there is no moving forward. In that, there really is no peace, because peace assumes that there are two people that can work together to find peace. What it does is, in the end, in my opinion, leads to annihilation and war.
Very, very cogent arguments. I'm going to add on to them, if I may, two more. One coming from antiquity. I don't think we even know the source of it fully. And the other one closer to home, from our Judeo-Christian heritage. The one from secular antiquity is that the first rule of ethics is first do no harm. First, do no harm. There are lots of people out there who scream for all kinds of solutions, never thinking that, well, what does this mean, actually? Who's going to be impacted by it? The only thing they're concerned about is impacting the environment, but not the human environment. What does this mean to people on the ground? How does this play out in the search for real peace? Real tranquility, real brotherhood between people. It's slogans. So I'm uncomfortable with any kind of program out there which claims to speak truth to power, but won't address the impact of what they're saying. It's nice that you have the democratic socialists of America who are saying we're not doing enough, and we've got to do more. It's easy for them to say when it's somebody else's dime, and what they're proposing is a kind of socialism, which we know is a failure. And we've had a whole century, the 20th century, to play with it and to see the evils of it. So I don't trust that slogan. But then there's the second factor, and that's where as religious people, I am very wary of these programs, not just BDS, which hits home because it is profoundly anti-Semitic, but anything like it. And that is Isaiah. When Isaiah, in that classic passage, said, "Don't burden me with your fast days and your prayers. This is the kind of fast that I want. Feed the poor, clothe the naked, give of yourself." I think that what Isaiah is saying, if he would have been around in the 21st century, he would blame it on his gym. No pain, no gain. If all that you have to offer is slogans and getting a lot of other people to produce slogans and hatred and t-shirts without really being able to do something about it, it's suspect.
This is important. I want to intervene here, because we're preaching this kind of equity, and yet we, in our demonization, leave people in the wake and create a whole new generation of yet more victims. when we look at the model, the biblical model that you just presented, what you're saying is, all right, instead of telling you how bad you are, I need to be doing good. I need to be making a difference. I need to be feeding the poor. I need to be loving those who are unlovely. I need to be making a difference that way. We have a lot of blame that gets put out, and it makes me feel better to say, you know, I'm part of the woke, the enlightened. But what are you really doing for the person across the street or the person that's in need? If all of us were doing that, and that's talking to myself as well, we would have a lot less of the world's problems. And interestingly enough, the very anti-Semitic nature of BDS, and in relation to Ben and Jerry's. Ben and Jerry's was taken over by a British company, Unilever, who was the propagator of this initial statement that, you know, this is inconsistent with the Ben and Jerry's label. Now, interestingly enough, they did that without consulting Ben and Jerry's, who later the board said, yeah, you know, we're in agreement. Nonetheless, something very interesting that was brought up by one of our producers, Giselle, was that this British company in Great Britain, there is a much greater Islamic presence than there is in the United States. So this seems very, very, well, yeah, this is just a way. Yeah, this is how we should think. This is what we should believe. But Rabbi, I want to get your comments on this. Where the United States is concerned, people don't realize that many states in our country have a specific anti-BDS ideology and laws. And so we have people like the Israeli foreign minister calling on these states with anti-BDS laws to re-examine maybe their relationship with Ben and Jerry's. What does that look like? What are they expecting that it should look like? What are some of these laws? Let's take that on a bit.
Well, you actually answered your own question before, maybe without knowing it. Airbnb didn't give in because of public pressure or, oh boy, we made a mistake. We didn't know we were hurting people's feelings. They gave in because there were lawsuits that were brought, and it was the bottom line. And actually, I would be comforted today if I thought that the bottom line is ultimately going to govern all of corporate behavior. I'll tell you in a moment why I think that may no longer be true, which is one of the scariest things about the Ben and Jerry's debacle. But the only thing that is initially going to work to change Unilever's position, they've hid behind a contractual obligation to Ben and Jerry's to allow them to control anything to do with their social conscience. So they said, hey, it's not us. It's not us. And we're going to stay in Israel. We didn't do anything so bad. We just meant the settlements. It's not true because they went over the head of the board. The board actually wanted a full-fledged boycott of Israel, not the settlements, but all of Israel. And they actually spoke out publicly and said this was done without our approval and we're against it. We protest. But Unilever, despite contract, they have more leverage than they're willing to let on, which is why Unilever should still be the one who's addressed and pushed. Ben and Jerry like saying that they have no operational role in the organization. True, but that hasn't stopped them in the 20 years since they sold out for being there as the representatives of the company, for introducing new flavors, for coming up with new ideas of social protest. Their hands.
And I will let me intervene here real quick too. As of yesterday, one of the chair members of Ben and Jerry's independent board of directors had made the announcement. She said, "Well, I'm not anti-Semitic, but I'm proud of Ben and Jerry's for taking a stance to end sale of its ice cream in the occupied Palestinian territory. But I'm not anti-Semitic." So wanted to just put that in there. This is. you know, there's a lot more to this story.
Thank God much of the United States, to the chagrin of BDS, has subscribed to the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which includes extreme anti-Israelism and the denial that Israel is a legitimate state. Ms. Mittal, the chairman of the independent board of Ben & Jerry's, has produced no less than 100 anti-Israel tweets in her life, including one that the establishment of the state of Israel was a catastrophe. So her hands are not clean at all, and I will deny that she is not an anti-Semite. There are people, I think she's a conscious anti-Semite, but there are even more dangerous people out there who are anti-Semitic and don't realize it, meaning that they've never examined their own behavior to see that they don't look at Israel or Jews the same way they do other people. That double standard is anti-Semitic, like it or not. The other thing that I was referring to, but I find particularly dangerous here, is that she's not the only one who has gotten into corporate America with a strong sense of where the social conscience of the organization ought to be. Meaning, whereas it was taken for granted by people in the financial world, and still is taken that way for most, that a corporation's only real responsibility, and that is true as a matter of law, by the way, is to shareholders, and not to anybody else, and not to Greta Thunberg or whoever is your darling at the moment. Corporations have a life of their own, but they have a fiduciary responsibility to their investors. That has changed. We see more young people in corporations, in high places in corporations, who've basically absorbed what they did in colleges, which are notoriously far left, anti-US and anti-Israel. And that's become part of their persona. And that now has crept into the corporate protocols of America. And that spells a real problem for all of us, especially for people in the religious community who are going to see corporate moxie standing behind the increased efforts of many people on the left to completely undo religion and religious values and treat them as in conflict with the basic humanity of all of us. It's religion itself which is an oppressor and has to be shut down. The fact that many of these people are now in positions of responsibility of corporate America means that we're going to be looking at cooperation between corporate America, the Fifth Estate journalists, and the government. You know, the government wanted Facebook to shut down Donald Trump. They got it. That's a pretty dangerous alliance there. And we're going to see more of this coming from corporate America. That's part of the story of this Ben and Jerry's thing.
Well, in our final few moments together, I want to talk more about the deeper story, and that's the God story. If we include a God story, we know that God is no respecter of persons. God doesn't say that because of your political leaning, you have more intrinsic value than the person over here with this political leaning. Because you live on this side of a border, you have more intrinsic value to God than someone on the other side. We all come with failings, with struggles, with sin, with poor choice abilities and having made poor choices. And we come with the ability to do great work. We have essentially divided ourselves into these tribes of these people versus these people with these people, this race versus this race, when indeed we are all part of the human race. You alluded to a powerful solution, Rabbi, that may not translate today in from big corporations and from political groups or world leaders, but it can start in my life today. And that's how I choose the biblical God story that inspires me to make a difference in my world today. And if we all do that, perhaps that can catch fire and we can see a difference in the world at large. I'd like your thoughts.
I think that that's perfect. I would just add two minor grace notes to that. And one is coming back to Isaiah again, which is that not only is what you're saying consistent with biblical values and biblical truth, but the truths of the Bible should be used in the privacy of our own minds and our own meditation as ways of measuring up who we are. In the sanctity of our own selves, and when we're speaking to God last thing before we go to sleep at night, and trying to measure, like, how good are we? What are the things that we have to change? To me, part of that message of Isaiah is that if you're not doing something about it, it's not only that it's a different program, but you have to really mistrust whether you've found a niche in which you can feel comfortable without having to do anything. If it's not costing you anything, wow, it's not going to be as valuable to God. One of the people who made the strongest impression on me in my last years in L.A. was a Hispanic pastor. He's the head of a large, actually very traditional evangelical network of Hispanic evangelical churches. His name is Walter Contreras. If you're listening, I hope you're not going to have to blush. But he knocked me off my feet when he told me that in earlier years, in wanting to help the poor and the street people and the homeless, he felt that he couldn't do it without understanding fully what it is that they were going through. So for 2 years, he lived on the street. He lived on the street in order to be able to feel what it was like, to feel their pain. That is the kind of, I don't know how many he helped, I'm sure he did, but to me, what was important about that was here's a guy who means business, who's not ready to hide behind slogans, who's willing to feel pain in his own life to be on the right side. And I hope this is not cultural appropriation, but when we don't do that, it's sort of like what in your circles, Michelle, you call cheap grace. When you're able to tell everybody what a great person you are because you're on the right side of wokeness, but it doesn't cost you anything. Quite the contrary, it's an entree into all the right circles. Then you have to be suspicious of whether this is really what God wants. Of what God really wants of you. I forgot the other point I was going to make, but.
Well, the first one was so good. I mean, how could you get past that? It really, in other words, folks, it's not about tooting your own horn or who can be loudest. St. Francis of Assisi gave one of my favorite quotes, and that is, preach the gospel. And when necessary, use words. So I would like to let my deeds speak for my faith and speak for what matters to me, not my hate of someone else, not how badly I can bring you down, but how I can lift my neighbor up. Rabbi, I enjoy our conversations so very much. One of the greatest reasons is because we not only talk about the issues, which are very important, but we cut it all down, get rid of the fluff and the hyperbole, and we get to the point where we realize that each one of us has a special place in God's heart, and we can all make a difference. As you've been watching today, I want to give special thanks to one of our sponsors, and that is the folks from Real Bearded
Men. From Wild Scrub Brush to Gentleman Refined Stash Wax, from Real Bearded Men at MyMichelleLive.com.
A product that I can recommend, but I will never use, Stash Wax, right there. So thank you very much for our sponsors. You can go to MyMichelleLive, like us, share us, comment, and continue to support people who are getting more of the word out. Because if we do not, we will lose the freedoms that we have enjoyed so very much of the press. We will lose the freedoms of the freedom of speech that has been so hard fought for. These stories need to be talked about and they need to be told. No, you don't have to agree. But if you really believe in freedom, you have to allow the voice to be heard. Rabbi, thank you for letting your voice be heard. It is always a pleasure.
Thank you, Michelle. You're great. I love being on your show.
More news and views at MyMichelleLive.com.